Good morning, everybody, on Eastern Standard Time anyway, and good whatever for people in other parts of the world. I'm Ian Williams. I'm president of the Foreign Press Association, and we're continuing our series of briefings about the current crises of the day, especially in Ukraine, by examining what the United Nations just down the road here from us in New York is doing, or more significantly, is not doing. And our panel have all had recent works published criticizing the UN. And I think the other thing that we all have in common, including myself, is that we're sort of inside outsiders. We have been up and down to the 38th floor. We've known secretaries general, and we have we've looked at the UN. We support the UN without illusions, because we know that it is a somewhat floppy instrument at the best of times. But I think all of us in our various articles and pieces have shown, have demonstrated that we really think that it has underperformed our low expectations during the Ukraine crisis. And I would point out, some of us are very disappointed in other ways. The South African resolution that comes today, being debated in the emergency special session of the General Assembly, it's calling everybody to cease hostilities, etc., etc. And I really thought, when I was looking at it, as a lifelong anti-apartheid campaigner from my school days onwards, it was a bit like passing a resolution asking everyone to be racially harmonized in South Africa. You know, it was a call for racial harmony without saying how you do it and how you stop the oppressors from oppressing. It's that blunting of the UN's message that we're seeing now. But there are, apart from cries for help, Stephen Schlesinger in his piece in Past Blue did explicitly discuss historical references on how the UN can effectively intervene. It's quite clear that Moscow is susceptible to public opinion, because otherwise they wouldn't have so many trolls working on shaping public opinion across the world. So there is calls for, let's say, stronger stands. But Stephen, you explain what the present Secretary General could do if he were so motivated about the situation, please.
Thank you, Ian. Yeah, my problem is the following. We've had a Secretary General, and he's now in his second term, Mr. Guterres. He's facing probably the most terrible situation crisis that this world has faced since the Cuban Missile Crisis. A possible showdown, a nuclear showdown between Russia and the United States. And he has, in my view, abdicated his role, his responsibility as Secretary General of the United Nations. The one critical piece that came out of the UN founding conference in San Francisco in 1945 was that after two cataclysmic world wars, killing over 90 million people, the one thing the UN was all about was security, 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 stopping war. So this is the one mission that any Secretary General has to do. Has to focus on. And frankly, when Putin had put his forces around Ukraine before he actually attacked it, at that point, the UN should have intervened. At that point, in my view, Guterres should have sent emissaries to Moscow to find out what was in Putin's head, what was going on. And also equally so to Ukraine to see whether there was something that could be settled. Of course, at that point, we didn't know whether he would invade or not, but that was no excuse. He, as Secretary General, had responsibility for peace in the world. And once the attack happened, I credit Guterres for his courage in taking on the Russians and denouncing the invasion. And that was, something a Secretary General rarely will go after one of the members of the Security Council member P5 that has a veto power. Of course, this is his second term, so he doesn't really care that very much about getting reelected. But the fact is, he did take the Russians on. And yet all he's done is issue statements. He has not, in my view again, sent out emissaries to take the temperature of Moscow and Kyiv and see if there's some way beyond just European diplomats that can be worked out settlement through the UN. Admittedly, he's already taken a position against Russia. So that in a sense bars him from being acting as a neutral mediator, but he could have sent his deputies. He could have done a number of different things. Now I'll say one last thing. The UN has not been totally uninvolved. Right now there are about 7 UN agencies which are all working on the humanitarian side of this conflict. And that is great. But I feel that the Secretary General in his one single mission as Secretary General has so far failed in his responsibility.
Next, Mark, who was working with Ban Ki-moon, the immediately previous Secretary General. And you know, Ban Ki-moon was, in my opinion, much misunderestimated. He was very quiet and sometimes appeared below the radar screen. But by all accounts, I think some of the people here could back me up on this, when he actually met people, he would dress them down. He would tell them when they were breaking the law and when they were going beyond the bounds. Unfortunately, he didn't tell the public this, which is what we really want in this particular case. What would you say about that?
Well, thanks, Ian, and thank you very much. Nice to meet you, Steve and David. Well, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right about that. Of course, because we all had to take turns listening to the phone calls, and he would occasionally berate people, but when occasionally they would berate him back. I remember him saying once, "This Prime Minister of Malawi, she's so rude." But in all seriousness, don't forget that he and his key advisor, Kim Won-soo, would talk about the new Department of Political and Peacekeeping Affairs as being the kind of gold standard. This is going directly to what Stephen was saying about the political role of the United Nations and what an important department this would be, and if it was playing perhaps a fuller role right now, because what some people are saying is that is Rosemary DiCarlo, who is a very experienced diplomat and a Russian speaker, is not playing as full a role as she should. And you do get this very distinct impression. We know, for instance, that Secretary General Guterres, just prior to the Russian invasion, which really, apart from the Biden administration's secret services, nobody really seemed to believe was going to happen. But he was at the Munich Security Conference, and he was supposed to go to the Congo, and his plane was diverted because I think there was an effort to try and get him to go to Moscow. But quite early on, I think that, as Stephen was just saying, you know, Guterres had made that criticism of and come out quite strongly verbally on Moscow. But the question beyond Guterres is whether he should be traveling around and risking his everything on this, because I mean, the other thing, of course, we tend to forget is a lot of secretary generals will be there at the final event when something has been achieved. They don't want to take great risks in advance just in case. But right now, this situation is so serious, it would suggest that really Guterres should be traveling around as much as he could. And if not him, he should be sending others, because what we're getting, and we just saw this briefly, I don't want to hold things up, but briefly today we saw Reuters reporting that Poland is going to offer NATO to put peacekeepers into Ukraine. Well, I mean, we don't know, you know, how serious this is, but really this is something that the United Nations should be doing. This should all be happening, to my mind, at UN level. And, you know, aside from these strong statements, we're not seeing these interventions. Why, for instance, is the Secretary General not trying to convene this meeting between Putin and Zelensky? Where are the peacemongers? That's the big question.
Well, you just mentioned that. A more vigorous denunciation of the Russian misappropriation of the idea of peacekeepers might have been in order. You might say that it's part of the intellectual property of the United Nations, and to to abuse, as the Russians have done frequently, calling their invading forces peacekeepers, has actually devalued the concept considerably. So, you know, a forthright denunciation of that in advance might have been advisable. David, you made some of the similar points about this, and you've also had experience of previous secretaries general, you know, none of whom come out like knights in shining armor, because they have to consider the survival of the organization. If you really mess up with the United States, will the UN survive? And there are sort of, it's fuzzy logic that's involved here quite often. But the fuzzy logic seems to have fallen by the wayside at the moment, I gather from your piece.
Oh, Ian, thanks for inviting me, and delighted to see Stephen and Mark. Where's the courage? Where's the courage of the organisation on the 38th floor? I think we could probably all agree that Antonio Guterres was dealt a pretty poor hand at the beginning of this conflict. The Security Council meeting at the end of February, forgive me, with Russia chairing a debate notionally to condemn the war that it had just launched, and then of course vetoing it and bringing China and India and even the UAE, which now holds the chair, to abstain. That meeting was farcical, tragic, and an indictment of what the UN should be standing for. And so we can acknowledge there that the Secretary General had a pretty poor hand going into this. But from where I sit, having worked with Kofi Annan, and I'd agree with you on Ban Ki-moon grew notably in my time with him in terms of using his voice. My question is why wasn't the Secretary General finding a way? If the Prime Ministers of Poland and the Czech Republic could make their way by train, albeit across Ukraine, to get to Kyiv and see President Zelensky, then my question is why isn't Guterres, why hasn't he done the same? Why has he not been to Moscow? I find it implausible, having lived in Moscow in the fairly dark days of the late 1980s, I find it implausible that the Kremlin, even under Putin, would have blocked a visit by the Secretary General of the United Nations. And I find it implausible almost that they would have prevented his message. They may have tweaked it, they may have played with it in translation, but I find it difficult to believe that they would have blacked him out on Russian state television. So really my question is why the Secretary General hasn't gone a whole lot further personally. I'd offer you this one thought, having worked as well with former presidents and prime ministers who came to the UN as heads of agencies, like Guterres. I worked with him when he came to Washington as head of UNHCR, the refugees. But I think of the politicians, the former politicians I worked with at the UN, former presidents, former prime ministers, and I would hear them voicing the risk-benefit equation, which of course a politician always has in mind. And to me, the Secretaries General that I worked with and came to admire, Kofi Annan and Ban Ki-moon, were thinking beyond that. They were thinking the voice of humanity. And where does the voice of humanity go at a moment of crisis? And clearly, to me, the present Secretary General is weighing the risk-benefit equation. Okay, if I take this risk and I make a personal trip or I send emissaries, what is going to be the risk to me, the organization, and what is the benefit? And frankly, from my distance now, I'm saying, sir, that's not where you should be. You should be in the place of saying, I am the lead voice of humanity, as was certainly Kofi Annan. And how do I use that microphone? And for me, standing in Moscow and standing in Kyiv and saying in these days, in the name of humanity, let's find a way to stop this, was exactly where he should be.
Well, one of the roles of the United Nations and the Secretary General, I've always felt, is to provide a ladder to allow people to climb down from the trees that they've got themselves stuck in.
Yep.
And in this case, the ladder's been sort of devalued. It's a very ropey ladder that he can offer at the moment. It hasn't got the stature, for all the reasons we've just got, that it had a decade or two decades ago. You know, a sort of Dag Hammarskjöld or Hugh Tant can go in there and say, look, you know, you can climb down gracefully with my help. But at the moment, there's no graceful way to climb down on a ladder that's so flexible and ropey. How can the UN get its edge in there, as it were?
Well, we do have to accept, Ian, surely, that the attrition of 10 years of Syria in the Security Council with the Assad regime murdering its own people with Russian support and with the use, for example, of chemical weapons, this has done untold damage to the political arm of the UN. I would always argue, as you know, that there's another side to the UN that is still doing great work day in, day out right now, whether we look at refugees, whether we look at the World Food Programme, whether we look at UNICEF in Ukraine, all of those agencies are doing terrific work. The problem is the political arm, the 38th floor, the Security Council, let's be clear, has suffered devaluation and degradation particularly because of Syria. I would argue, going back, the reason why I joined the UN and why Kofi Annan wanted me to work for him was the Iraq War in 2003. And we have to remember that at the end, the Allies, the United States and Britain, chose not to seek the approval of the United Nations Security Council before invading Iraq. And this, looking back, was a watershed for the organization and for the credibility, let's put it that way, of the Security Council.
David, if I may, I think this whole argument does, in the end, boil down once again to consistency or lack of it. And of course, you know, perhaps out of all of these things, interesting things may happen. The non-aligned movement may come back to life. We're actually beginning to see some of all of this, because I think it's become difficult for many countries to say, well, you know, we are 100% behind the Security Council, we're 100% behind this decision or that decision, when there is this lack of consistency, when member states can point to Western Sahara, they can point to Iraq, as you were saying, they can point, although it was a bit of a breeze in comparison to anything else, to the American invasion of Grenada, when the head of state was Her Majesty the Queen, they forgot to tell her about it. So I think the consistency thing is ever so powerful, but it just kind of, but just get very briefly back to your point about the, and Stephen's point too, about the political arm of the UN. There is a big question is, what is happening with the Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs? This was a great Ban Ki-moon achievement in many ways. Got a very, very smart diplomat leading that in Rosemary DiCarlo. What sort of role, you know, why are we not seeing more from her? You know, I'm sure she is capable and wants to do more, but isn't that a question we should be perhaps asking as well?
I certainly agree with that. I mean, she is the second most important figure in the UN. She should have been sent on a mission of some sort. She's totally disappeared. There may be stuff she's doing behind the scenes. But I also want to address a point that David raised, which is that the credibility of the UN has been hampered by Syria and some of these other ongoing crises that have not been resolved and that the UN has sort of failed in. I will point out, though, that you thought, having solved the Cuban Missile Crisis, and by the way, that to me is the finest example of a UN Secretary General going immediately into a crisis and trying to solve it without worrying about what the consequences will be. But he also tried for the next 6 or 7 years to resolve the Vietnam crisis, the Vietnam War. He failed. But nonetheless, by getting the UN involved, it did put pressure on the US government. It did put pressure on Johnson to try to come to some sort of agreement to end that war. So even if the UN fails, it doesn't mean it's actually failing. And I think that to my belief, a Dag Hammarskjöld, a Hugh Thant, a Kofi Annan, a Ban Ki-moon would have been all over this. they would have been involved in this from the very beginning, as those forces, as the Russian forces were encircling Ukraine. They wouldn't have sat there and just waited to see how it all evolved. And by the way, Guterres, he doesn't have to worry about getting reelected. It's not like it's going to be a black mark on his record with Russia. He knows he's not going to come, you know, be gold for a third term. So he could have taken these chances. So in that sense, I just have to wonder what is stymieing him in the one essential job the Secretary General has always had, which is to stop wars.
In the context of the UN, you're right. Being a lame duck can make you an attack duck if you treat it properly, so that you don't have to worry about the consequences when you go. You've put it down there, but there's also this question of the relationship between the United States and, you know, in all fairness, we have had now several terms of presidents who have continually denigrated the United Nations. They've tried to defang it. It didn't have that many teeth to begin with. But how can you turn around and call Putin a war criminal when you have not yet rescinded the decisions outlawing the International Criminal Court? How can you say the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force and then tacitly ratify the Moroccan invasion of Western Sahara against UN decisions, or continue to ratify the Golan Heights? The United States has a lot to answer here for in its role in eroding the fabric of international law, doesn't it?
Yes, well, let me just make a point. You know, the Republican Party has always been an isolationist party. America First is not a new thing that Trump introduced. The Democratic Party has been multilateral. They have embraced the UN. All the examples you've put forward have been decisions made by a Republican government. And a Democratic government never was gonna invade Iraq. They were never gonna do some of the things that you mentioned. So you have to understand that democracy is, you know, unreliable in that sense. You can have different parties taken over at different times. And to the extent that you try to retain the values of the country, it's always a difficult situation. But we come back to the fact that, well, the one thing that most people were so frightened about was that the United States would never really join the United Nations. It wouldn't stay for the 77 years it has stayed through all different administrations. And if the UN, if the US had not joined the UN, it would have been a flop from the very beginning. That's why they put the UN in New York City, because they figured it would be much more difficult for the US to leave the UN if the organization was actually implanted in a New York, in an American city. So I'm just glad that the US has stayed by the UN, irregardless of its mistakes that are, as you point out, very glaring.
By the way, Stephen, in passing, the America's relationship with the United Nations, of course, reached its nadir under Trump. But I recall a story that Ban Ki-moon told about Donald Trump when he was not president of the United States, very keen to bid for a tender for the renewal of the building at UN headquarters. And apparently he came to see Ban Ki-moon and he said, "I can do this cheaper than anybody else." And Ban Ki-moon said, "Well, send in a tender." And he never did. So perhaps that's what, perhaps why the UN remained a bit longer in New York. But
it's why it's still intact, perhaps, as well.
Why it's still there. But I was just going to say, the General Assembly, I mean, look, we've had this vote. I think 10 times in 50 years, the General Assembly has voted through these condemnatory resolutions when there's been complete stasis the Security Council is incapable of acting.
And this is the Uniting for Peace resolution.
I was just going to come on to that, because I think that the two resolutions that are up for debate and vote tomorrow are around the humanitarian issue. There's the South African one, which doesn't mention Russia's invasion, and there's the other one. But there is this issue of the Uniting for Peace resolution, which I think you mentioned in your piece, Stephen. And if that actually were to go through, that would mandate the Secretary General to come back to the General Assembly with a plan to bring about peace and security in the Ukraine, including the use, if necessary, of military force. Now, I'm just, this is, I suppose it's way out there, but I mean, they, surely people must be thinking about this and thinking, how practically could that be? Could that require, or could that ask member states to provide peacekeepers, you know, member states who are not supportive of either, who have been in the middle, if you like? Could that be a way forward? But, you know, it does seem that the General Assembly is going back to, a lot of this is going to the General Assembly now, and there's a new opportunity for political leadership to come out of that.
Was that addressed to Stephen directly?
Well, I was wondering, whoever, but I mean, it just seems that to me that uniting for peace is possibly a next step or a future step.
No, I should point out on that, if I may, because I was reporting at the time, one of the reasons, once again, the United States has spent 20 years denigrating, debriding the General Assembly and uniting for peace, because in its post-Korean avatar, it was pulled up by the Palestinian mission to condemn inaction over Israeli occupation. And so for the last 20 years, at the behest of lobbyists, the United States has said the General Assembly is not, as it's only persuasive, it doesn't have any authority, uniting for peace is an obsolete procedure. So suddenly they need it. And somebody in the State Department is saying, whoops, maybe we should have kept our mouths shut earlier.
Well, I will say that the Uniting for Peace, you know, it came about during the Korean War as a way of avoiding a veto by the Russians during that period. So it's been around for a long time, and it, as pointed out, hasn't been used that often. But I think Mark's point is a good point. You know, we should be exploring further creative ways to use that procedure. And certainly, if the General Assembly were to mandate that the Secretary General or one of his emissaries get involved, that's got to have a powerful impact on the way the UN will address this issue. But I do think that, you know, they're all, of course, as you point out, Ian, there are all sorts of hypocrisies around this issue. And you know, you have to live with the hypocrisy. Doesn't mean, because it's hypocritical, doesn't mean you can't use it.
David, do you want to come in on this?
I wouldn't get my hopes up over the General Assembly being able to change the dynamic. And I think your point, Ian, is a very good one in terms of the denigration that body has suffered down the years from the United States. I'd come back to the point of how, for example, Washington has shown engagement with the UN over the past 20 odd years, because it was in Washington that I worked for Kofi Annan and then Ban Ki-moon. And I think I disagree somewhat that the appointment of an Undersecretary General for Political Affairs to be an American, which was very much a George W. Bush insistence, non-negotiable, when Ban Ki-moon became Secretary General. I'd very much question whether that was the way to go and where it's left us. Rosemary DiCarlo, I've worked with, absolutely fine diplomat, understanding, wise, thoughtful, yes, a Russian speaker. But on the other hand, I'm aware that probably not, given the kind of muscle or clout from Washington, D.C., to really shape the way positively going forward that the UN operates. So to me, it's not a surprise. I have a problem, and always did the minute I joined the UN, that I think the way that the big jobs are divvied up between the main players is disastrous for the organization, and particularly for the 38th floor, because you end up with, I noticed the other day that the head of counterterrorism is a Russian. Please, really? How can this be? And why would this be? Well, we know why it would be, because they've clearly gone to the well at some point, Moscow, and said, we want that job, just as the British government used to go to the well for political affairs, now for humanitarian, because that was part of the trade-off when George W. Bush insisted that the United States had political affairs I'd be of a view that any Secretary General needs a much greater degree of freedom to actually pick the best people, maybe with new ideas, maybe those who haven't served forever in one particular government, going to New York or Geneva, effectively to listen to their own governments as much as they do to the central authority of the United Nations. And there I really do despair, because I see nothing in this particular period that has changed, despite much talk of thing. My mind goes back to Kofi Annan absolutely insisting in the Oval Office that he needed three names to be the head of a major agency which would fall to the Americans. And you know what happened? He effectively got one name.
We've all pointed here to the worm in the bud of the United Nations, the fact that from the beginning, the high officers were divvied out amongst the P5, which is why the Secretary General quite often ignores them. But one of the distinctive things, and we all had experience of Kofi Annan, was he had a very effective triumvirate or whatever outside, where he appointed people who were, you know, outspoken, and he allowed them to speak and to explore, and if necessary, quietly disown them afterwards. But he, if they were successful, he could claim credit. If they went too far, he could gently restrain them. And it was a very effective maneuver with people like Shashi Tharoor and Mark Malik Brown.
Ian, with Ban Ki-moon, he was given a shortlist of one. I was just minded what David was saying. He was given a shortlist of one by David Cameron, which was a former health minister called Andrew Lansley for one of the humanitarian posts. I can't remember which one it was now. And we got wind of this, and we started sending up cuts from all the various press to put Mr. Lansley in an appalling light, because he's pretty appalling.
Yes, it wasn't difficult.
and Ban Ki-moon said no. So they can say no to people. But I guess that, you know, it's the issue now. What should Guterres be doing right now?
Well, if he'd appointed somebody, I mean, I'm pulling it out the hat because I don't know whether we've done it, but somebody with a big ego and a big mouth like Mark Malik Brown, who could turn around and say, it's insupportable that the Russians will assume the chair of the Security Council under these circumstances.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's that type of initiative that we're missing here. It's insupportable that the Russians can call these people peacemakers. And we're not hearing those voices, because all we're hearing is the one bland voice saying, we must negotiate, we must have peace. I mean, you know, this is, it's like Charles Dickens saying that the world problems will be solved if Scrooge goes round with a goose to Tiny Tim.
And surely, Ian, this goes back to that question, where's the courage? I think we're looking at a Secretary General and a team around him, who I'm sure are working the phones. You hear that they're working the phones and that he believes that there are folks out there. Erdogan in Turkey seems to be one that he believes could play a mediator role. But we're not seeing the kind of courageous leadership that we would identify with the organization requiring right now. In fact, the world crying out for it. I, on one level, to come back to that point I made earlier, think this is very much a sort of a politician's view, which dictates the way you go. But it's also, in a sense, to my mind, a little bit of stage fright. I have a sense of a Secretary General, a politician, very skilled, Southern European politician, having worked in Spain and Portugal and Italy as a young correspondent. I can tell you they love finesse. They're very good at the finesse. And we've got to give him credit. Guterres avoided a showdown with Trump in the early years of Trump very skillfully. He got out of the way and made sure it never happened. But now I think, you know, the big stage calls, and to Mark's point, we're looking at a politician weighing the risk, weighing the danger, rather than seeing the role. And the role is to get out there with that microphone. Kofi Annan always used to say, the only weapon I've got is the microphone. And, you know, saying it in New York or Geneva that you're outraged by what the Russians are doing, it doesn't cut it, does it, Stephen?
No, I would agree. And in fact, I think you make a really interesting point, which is that if Guterres is a former politician, former prime minister of Portugal. Kofi Annan was not a politician. People would criticize him for being a bureaucrat. But in fact, it was the bureaucrat who showed the more dynamic role for the UN as a secretary general than the politician. Dag Hammarskjöld was not a politician in that sense. I think he'd been appointed to the cabinet, but he'd never really run for office, as far as I know. And he was far more willing to take creative steps and seeing where the UN could go in unprecedented ways. So they were not conflicted by, as you both you and Mark have pointed out, this weighing the pluses and minuses of every decision. They were willing to go almost with their gut, or at least with the ideals of the UN. And I think that really illustrates the problems of a politician taking over the role of Secretary General.
One of the roles of the InfoWars that the Russians have shown, and others, Trump as well, is you continually, let us say, throw excreta at your party. And even if it's not true, palpably false, it has the effect of eroding their standing. They tried this with Kofi Annan. I mean, it was because he had palpable moral integrity. They started the alleged oil for food scandal. They invented the alleged oil for food scandal and went after him. It was an attempt to erode his moral superiority. So in reverse, I mean, the question of the Russian seat on the Security Council is something very, all of them except America, the Security Council, it's a sort of Freudian phallus substitute for all of them, the British, the French, the Chinese, you know, okay, we mightn't be, but we've got the veto. Do you think there's room to just continue with tongue in cheek to point out that Russia is not in the charter as a Security Council member and challenge their credentials? It mightn't be effective, but it would certainly throw them slightly off balance, I think.
Ian, are you referring to when the red flag came down and was it a British diplomat?
Well, I remember it was Sir David Hannay who the Americans told me snuck in late at night and changed the name pad.
Yes. Well, I mean, so it could have been Ukraine, it could have been Kazakhstan, it could have been Uzbekistan, it could have been any of the former Soviet republics, I suppose. But my take would be that actually it's so important at some stage. We've been asking about where are the peacemongers, where's the courage, where's the political direction to all of this? And you've got to have all of these lines open and to push Russia out of absolutely everything, which means that it's going to be very difficult to open up any lines. And I'd simply say on the whole issue of disinformation and mud throwing and all the rest of it, what's quite striking to me is how feeble the Russian propaganda efforts have been. And how ineffective they have been. They've been extremely clumsy. They really have lost any kind of public information war. So I do wonder about both the effectiveness of the Russian PR machine, and also looking at the sort of the columns of stalled tanks in Ukraine, how effective their military is as well. But aside from that, I mean, I just think it seems to me to be very important to keep the lines of communication open, because sooner or later there's got to be a ceasefire. There's got to be some kind of end to this horrendous war.
I agree with Mark. I think the point when the UN was set up in 1945, the criteria for joining the UN had nothing to do with human rights. It just had to do with security. They were they were willing to accept dictators. They were as well as democracies, because what they saw as the most important thing was to bring these countries together so that when the conflicts did break out, they could, you know, they could deal with them from the point of view of the organization, because these countries would be within the organization. To kick out Russia, it seems to me, defeats the whole point of the UN. Of course, we're talking realpolitik in this sense. It violates our own sense of human rights. But if you want to get peace, you have to deal with the enemy. The other point is there's a feeling that you could oust Russia. But I consulted with Larry Johnson, who used to be the legal advisor to Kofi Annan, among others, at the UN. There's no way you can kick out a country which has a veto power. They'll just veto it. So it's a kind of...
The point is, if you deny that they're actually a member of the Security Council because the Charter doesn't mention it...
Well, he also makes that
point. In the Soviet Union. What did he say about that?
He said that if there had been objections to that, it should have happened right around that time. The objections never happened. So the issue became moot. And therefore, from that point, from the legal point of view, there was really nothing more you could do.
Well, if Putin can question the sovereignty of Ukraine on dubious history, then surely it's okay to destabilize him by pointing out the insecurity of his own claims.
Well, you can play that game. Maybe it will help in some ways, but it's not going to happen. Russia's going to stay in the UN.
No, I don't expect UN security to drag the Russian ambassador out by his ear and kick him out the front door at any time soon, although it might be worth it. Which brings us, all of us also had to deal with somebody who's, Putin is an enigma, but even more so, I think all of us had experience of Sergei Lavrov when he was the UN ambassador, and a sophisticated and knowledgeable person who often stretched the truth. But I don't think I ever saw him actually break it completely the way he has been lately. I mean, Lavrov, with his experience at the UN, seems to have lost his marbles in terms of the statements that he comes out with, which make George Orwell seem like an amateur.
Or gain some extremely large golden marbles since he's been back in Moscow. It is very surprising, as you say. I mean, he was, he was always fantastic for journalists, quite erudite, that gravelly kind of Soviet persona. It is quite, because I right at the very beginning, like for what it's worth, like a lot of people, I thought, well, this guy is going to be like latter day Andrei Gromyko, Dr. Nit. But he's a sensible guy, presumably he's got some kind of handle on Putin, and then that appeared not to be the case. And then I started thinking, well, it really does look like a new Imperium, because at least when Putin was a simple KGB desk officer in Dresden, the Soviet Union was around, there were checks and balances. I'm not saying the Politburo and the Central Committee were the greatest democratic organizations, but they would have acted as some kind of restraint on Putin. And
during the Balkan Wars, Lavrov was very careful not to endorse what the Serbs were doing. He put it with reservations, and privately, he was even more strong about it whenever I spoke to him. In the delegates' lounge bar, which is a good place to get the truth out of a diplomat, I suppose. But the other point that's just come up is a question of China. Now, the one thing we know about the Chinese is they are very jealous and proud of their UN seat and very eager to play a full part in the UN. Do you think there's any role for the Secretary General to sort of invoke China in a big way, on a personal basis, to call Xi and say, look, you want to be with the big boys in the UN, this is your opportunity to rise above the fray and to show some statesmanlike qualities that would justify your P5 seat?
Well, I think if Biden's conversation with Xi last week didn't have any impact, I doubt if the Secretary General is going to have much impact. But maybe it'd be worth trying. At least it would show some activity on the side of the Secretary General, and it might, who know, add one more level to the pressure on Xi. I do think that, just getting back to Lavrov, just a funny note that, one of the payoffs for being Lavrov is apparently he's made millions of dollars under the system that Putin set up. There was a story in the London Times, I believe, about his daughter who lives in London and has a $2 or $3 million apartment and has investments all over the British Isles. So, these people around Putin are corrupted in many ways by the way Putin integrates them into his lavish way of living. So I might just add that to the Lavrov agenda.
He never brought her to the UN on the bring a daughter to work day, unfortunately. But that was... We have some questions I think people are asking for comparisons between the Iraq invasion and the invasion of Ukraine. I can think of answers to that. Do any of you want to explain what the similarities and differences are? In principle, same, but in practice, there are big differences.
Well, at least there was opposition in the United States. It wasn't successful, but from the very beginning, there was all sorts of debates going on. And, there was a feeling that there was a certain amount of really strong opposition to what was going on. In Russia, there was no chance to have a debate because Putin never allowed it. And in fact, kept us guessing about whether he was going to invade or not. So, that is the difference between at least a fledgling democracy like the United States and a, tyranny or authoritarian government, the one that Putin leads.
Yep, and if you look back at that in 2003, I think you'll find that in Britain there was, huge demonstrations, but more importantly, opinion polls showing that 70%, I think, of the United Kingdom was opposed to what Blair was doing. So a dramatic difference. I'd go back in terms of dealing with the question to what we've been hearing in recent days. I gather, I didn't see it personally, but I gather that Condi Rice has been out there with a straight face calling the invasion of Ukraine a war crime. And I'm going back and saying, well, hold on a second here. There was an invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. There was an invasion of Iraq in 2003. Where do we sit on that one? I think it's an extraordinary moment in those terms about the rights and wrongs and war crimes and the use of the word. I think we can all agree that the Russians are committing war crimes, but we surely equally have to look at what the West did. I'd offer one thought regarding this Sergei Lavrov, who is a very smart, able operator. My sense, and this is really journalistic rather than with my UN hat on, but my sense is that Putin and the people around him believe that they are in conflict with the West and that they have chosen this arena to have that conflict. And I say this because I think it goes well beyond the territory of the Donbass and Crimea and Odessa and now Kyiv. I really sense from Moscow, putting on my Moscow hat at the end of the 80s, living there, that we are listening to a regime which believes that it is in open conflict with the West now, and that this is not some momentary transitional period that he gets in and achieves this and then pulls out. And in terms of the relationship with China, I would therefore say that Xi must be looking on absolutely fascinated at the outcome and wondering what it means for his own expansionist view of our world. And there, I wonder whether we're digesting in the West what is really going on now with Putin and beyond.
In the past 30, 40 years ago, Khrushchev and Brezhnev could give the finger to the West and maintain their autarkic enclosed economic system. Even Mao Zedong, Chiu Enlai could do that. But now China is so thoroughly integrated into the world system, it has to think carefully about these things. And at the same time, Russia has made itself completely open without the economic development that China had. So, it is to some extent, I've always reckoned an oil state with nukes. It's got a very unbalanced economy.
I would also add the fact that, to David's point, that one of the reasons why, in my view, Putin is behaving the way he does. He does really see the old Russian Empire as something that he wants as a legacy before he dies. And the notion of reestablishing, whether it's the Soviet Empire or what he regards historically as the Russian area of influence, This is something he wants to be identified with. And I always thought, I've been struck by the fact that when he meets with leaders, he's always at that long comical table that puts one leader at the end and he's a mile away at the other end. And it's because he's so concerned about his health. He's 69 years old. He feels that with COVID, he may not have that many years left. So the legacy, his moment for the legacy is, the years are dwindling away. This is his time to finally act. And
there's actionable intelligence there, because now from looking at those tables, we know the range of an umbrella-tipped Novacek dart.
Yes, poor old Georgi Markov in London, the poor old Bulgarian who got it in his an umbrella in his in his ankle. I was just thinking though about Putin, because it's as though sometimes a lot of the commentators out there, suddenly things dawn upon them that things have been happening in slow motion and for a very long time. And we mustn't forget that Putin must surely have looked at the reaction to Grozny and Chechnya and thought, well, okay, these tactics, they work. And by the way, I'm not getting much criticism for this.
So the thing about the Armenians, of course.
Then there's Transdniestria. There's been this whole process has gone for a lot, a rear guard kind of action, which has now moved into this super gear, which very few people really, really thought he would actually do. But some people, including President Zelensky's chief advisor, was saying 2 years ago, this is exactly how it would play out. But there's all of these kind of deep seated reasons stuck in this autocrat's mind as to why he should be doing it. And nobody's really stopping him or dissuading him. But then we go back to China and President Xi, who we were talking about just a minute ago, and you do wonder, this is an enormous opportunity for the Chinese, but also possibly a lesson as well for the reasons you were saying, Ian, about the integration of China into the global economy. Because, what a lot of people were also speculating not so long ago, that if Russia moved into Ukraine, China could take this opportunity to do the same in Taiwan. And you do just kind of wonder if the Chinese, looking at this reaction, which has been a lot stronger than perhaps they anticipated, might actually have stayed their hands in Taiwan.
Stephen, if this is a sort of technical question just come up from Lena Sinha Connolly, what was the thinking amongst the drafters of the UN Charter regarding Chapter 2, Article 6? Sounds like your type of technical question, if you could.
Well, I mean, obviously that was the one of the crucial components of making the organization work, basically protecting the sovereignty of every nation that joined the UN, and in a way it's both been a plus and a minus. It's been a plus because most authoritarian or dictatorship love that proposal. It means that there'd be no interference with their political activity. But there does, as the years have passed, we remember Kofi Annan's famous speech in 1999 when he talked about the kinds of humanitarian intervention that the UN should be thinking about. There have been times when the UN should be being willing to take those kind of risks in order to fulfill the mission of creating a peaceful world. But yes, yet this is an eternal conflict between sovereignty and the global responsibility, and it will never go away as far as the UN is concerned.
Of course, Kofi's big innovation was to rebrand humanitarian intervention as the responsibility to protect.
Right.
And ironically, the dangers that were outlined about it in the beginning, many of us were very aware of, even as we supported it, have now been shown. Because, of course, Putin is using this to justify the intervention in the Donbass and the Crimea. He's protecting those poor Ukrainians against fascist legions on their shores. And it was even belatedly produced by Blair as an excuse for all the people they'd neglected, like the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs, for years. Until then, they suddenly developed an access of humanitarian consciousness about them. So, it is a two-sided concept, and we have to be very careful about these binary concepts that people produce. They have implications and they have ramifications. And we should remind the Russians that if they invoke one, then why aren't we helping the Chechens in their hour of need, or the people in Transnistria? All of the excuses he is using are usable against him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to pick up on what you'd said earlier, Ian, about the Russian agenda. Isn't it becoming rather clear that the decade, lest we forget, that Putin had effectively helping the Syrians with the world looking the other way, and the UN Security Council in particular unable to do almost anything to stop it? And you think now about the debate or the fear that is out there on the use of chemical and biological in Ukraine, and you look back and you realize that didn't the president of the United States say at one point that this was a red line, and if it was crossed in Syria, he would respond? It didn't happen. The UN Security Council was powerless because of the veto. And it should be said, it wasn't just the Russian, my memory is, it was also China at that point. I think we're looking at a model potentially that Putin has seen working tragically in Syria over many years. I mean, it was 10 years and applying it now. I'm not of the view that this is going to end very quickly and that we will suddenly hustle to some table somewhere and find a compromise. I wonder whether we're not seeing Putin and the Russians effectively apply the war of attrition and the Syrian model, terrifying as it is, to poor Ukraine.
The Grozny model too.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm. You can't accuse him of being racist. He uses it against Soviet citizens as well.
Yes. Well, that is the terrible irony that Mariupol and Odessa and these other cities that are being targeted have been, you know, primary Russian-speaking areas. And well, as we can see, what is happening. But you do wonder. Look, the best-laid plans and all of that, even harbouring these deep grudges, even having, you know, understandable concerns about NATO expansion, all of that, and it translates into a degree of brinkmanship, which for reasons we've discussed, the UN and other international players didn't manage to deter this invasion, which took place. But this invasion, which was, he described it as a military intervention, Putin, has now, it's in its 24th day, it's turned into this a battle of attrition against Ukrainian cities with a real weakness of the Russian military. And therefore the speculation that David's just referring to, the possible use of chemical weapons. But you know, how long does this continue for? You just wonder whether perhaps this actually goes into a new kind of type of Ukraine Cold War, which, because people forget, it's been 8 years in the East so far with 14,000 dead. This was before the invasion. Messy. But will it be hot conflict 3 or 4 months down the line? Well, I don't know.
And then 3 or 4 days, possibly.
And then the whole question of whether Putin will, in fact, use nuclear weapons, the small kinds, that as a kind of way of sort of planting the flag in the Russian flag in a way that has to have enormous repercussions around the world.
Well, he's shown that, like certain American generals in the past, he's prepared to destroy hamlets to save them. And he's prepared to massacre Russian speakers in order to rescue them from Ukrainian nationalist forces. So we really must look for the worst. We are coming towards the end now. This is Ian Williams, Foreign Policy with the Foreign Press Association. I really have to thank, I think, a well-rounded and objective discussion. None of us supported Putin, which makes it objective in reality. Stephen Schlesinger, David Smith, and Mark Seddon. We've covered a lot of the bases here. I think there's been a lot of scope for food for thought to go out and look further and to look closer at other news reports. We've got no boosterism here for one side or the other. I certainly didn't detect any signs of shining city on the hill in Washington preaching international law to the world. I think rather cynically disillusioned about it. But we could end with a plea to say that international law is for everybody, not just for Russians, but for Americans and Chinese as well. They've all signed on for it. They all signed on for the responsibility to protect. And they all signed the UN Charter, which basically says, thou shalt not invade other countries, based on fairly strong historical experience from 1939 onwards. So thank you very much for joining us, and we will have more coming up soon. Please join the Foreign Press Association, sign up for our lists, and if you have any suggestions for other topics and speakers of this degree of breadth and depth, I would like to think, please let us know. Thank you very much, everybody, again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.